Let's get you inside then, past all the police. I'll be right back, Atticus, he said to me. They rose and left me there, and I took the opportunity to check on Oberon. Where are you now?
Where do you expect? I'm totally a ninja wolfhound.
This car's ridiculous, though.
There's a revolting citrus air freshener in here. Do you know when his birthday is? We should get him one that smells like steak or Italian sausage.
I'm not sure they make them in those scents, Oberon.
Why not? You'd think they'd sell like milk bones, especially to a werewolf who's trying to compensate for something with a slick sports car.
Ow. Don't make me laugh right now. After giving Oberon a mental scratch on the head, I went to work on Fragora. I dispelled the camouflage as the ambulance arrived because I didn't want anyone to accidentally touch it and freak out, then placed a binding on the scabbard that would prevent it from moving farther than 5 feet from me. I had wanted to do this in the shop in case Fagles ever got his hands on it, but the binding takes longer to cast than camouflage and requires more power, and I didn't have access to much of either earlier. Jimenez came out to meet the paramedics and pointed them in my direction. Hal also came out and asked them to take me to Scottsdale Memorial Hospital, where my personal doctor could operate on me. I didn't really have a personal doctor, but the pack did. Dr. Snorri Yoderson was part of the pack himself, and he was the go-to guy for the paranormal community in the Phoenix area. He didn't raise an eyebrow at unusually fast healing, for example, and he was rumored to be an excellent bone setter and a quick surgeon. He was also willing to do things off the books. He had a whole surgical team who would work off record for obscene amounts of cash. I'd met him a couple of times when I ran with the pack. He was probably sixth or seventh in their hierarchy. But I'd never had cause to use his professional services, until now. The reason people like me need people like Snorri is because of reactions like the paramedics had when they examined me.
I thought you were supposed to have been shot, one of them said.
I was. Fluid in my lungs, I gurgled. I'm stable, but I need to see my doctor.
Well, where's the bullet hole?
Whoops. In my haste to prevent infection, I probably grew that skin over a bit too fast. It was still angry red, I'm sure, but not an open wound anymore. I'd put all my effort into closing up the skin and the lung, so the muscle tissue on either side was still pretty torn and would take some time to mend. And the skin and lung tissue needed time to strengthen, too.
It was a rubber bullet. Hit me there and caused internal bleeding, I said.
Detectives don't use rubber bullets. And even if they did and it caused some internal bleeding, you shouldn't have fluid in your lung from that.
Tell you what, sport. Put me on a stretcher and get me to my doctor and let him worry about it.
I was ready to go. I had done all I could here, including a recharge of my bear charm. Now I needed a surgeon and some time.
You mean to tell me your bullet wound healed up that fast?
I mean to tell you to give me one of those oxygen masks and get me out of here, and the sword comes with me.
I patted Fragora and the paramedic looked down, noticing it for the first time.
Doesn't leave my side.
What? We cannot allow weapons in the ambulance?
It's sheathed and it's incredibly valuable. Look at my shop.
I gestured toward the broken door.
I can't leave it here.
Hal, who had been hanging back silently watching the proceedings, loomed suddenly over the paramedic's shoulder.
Are you refusing to transport my client in a medical emergency?
No,
the paramedic replied, squinting up at him.
I'm refusing to transport his weapon.
You mean his priceless Celtic art? That's not a weapon, sir. It's a family heirloom of intense sentimental value. And the trauma he would suffer by being separated from it would be greater than any physical pain he currently feels, which, I notice, you've done absolutely nothing about since you arrived.
The paramedic clenched his jaw and exhaled sharply through his nose as he turned back to me.
Having lawyers?
He muttered quietly, thinking perhaps Hal wouldn't hear it. But werewolves tend to hear things like that.
That's right, sir. I am an effing lawyer, and I will effing file suit against you if you don't effing get my client and his art to Scottsdale Memorial right now.
All right, whatever,
huffed the paramedic, who could not stand to be bludgeoned with lawsuit threats for long. He and his partner went to get the stretcher, and shortly I was being loaded into the back of the ambulance, Fragora clutched in my right hand. Jimenez and the other cops were so busy worrying about what the press would do when they found out that a Phoenix detective had shot a Tempe detective stone dead
that they completely missed the fact that the sword Fagles had been hollering about actually existed.
"I'll see you there soon," Hal said with a wave. "Snorri will take good care of you. He knows you're coming. And don't worry about these guys," he said, indicating the paramedics. "Leif will pay them a visit tonight and they won't remember a thing."
Since the paramedics had finally put an oxygen mask on me, I couldn't answer, so I just gave a weak nod.
"Hurry back, Atticus. I'm going to be bored. These werewolves can't talk to me, and this camouflage stuff still kinda tickles."
"I'll probably see you by lunchtime tomorrow," I said back to my dog.
"Will there be sausage?"
"Only if Hal tells me you've been good."
"Oh, I'm gonna hold you to that,"
Oberon said, his mental voice fading as the ambulance put some distance between us.
"Okay, be good then,"
I projected and hoped he heard it. We warbled up Mill Avenue and doubtless gave the stoners loitering on the corner outside Trippy Hippie a quick jolt of paranoia.
Sirens just harsh on their mellow, man.
Drives in the back of an ambulance are simultaneously boring and stressful. I needed relief from both. Paramedic man wasn't about to talk to me anymore, so I decided to mess with him a bit, since Leif would make sure he wouldn't remember anything later. Am I above immature trickery? No. It keeps me young. Using a bit of power recently banked in my bear charm, I bound a few of the natural threads in the elastic band of his underwear to the fine hairs in the center of his back about 5 inches up. The result was an instant wedgie. Those have been funny for 2,000 years, but they're even more hilarious when your victim is sanctimoniously trying to behave like he knows more than you. I really shouldn't have done it, though, because his reaction, a girlish squeal followed by a high-octave,
"Ow! What the fuck?"
and an abrupt attempt to stand up, which cracked his head on the ceiling, got me laughing too hard, and that brought on a serious case of bloody hacking and a heaping spoonful of pain. Served me right, I suppose. I messed up the inside of the oxygen mask, then released the binding so he could calm down and help me. He never saw me laughing, so the poor guy thought his antics had caused me to become upset, and he was very solicitous as soon as he was able to reestablish some room in his shorts. Best ambulance ride ever. When we got to the hospital and his partner came around to help unload me from the back, he noticed that Mr. Wedgie had a flushed face.
"What happened?" he asked.
"He had a bit of distress during the ride, but he's stable for the moment," Wedgie said as they put my rolling stretcher on the ground and started pushing me toward the sterile electric doors of the emergency room.
"But you look like something happened to you," his partner replied. "Are you okay, man?"
"I'm fine," Wedgie snapped. "Nothing happened. Jesus Christ!" Well, I couldn't resist when he was lying like that, could I? Besides, there's that saying about laughter being the best medicine. Whoever said that didn't have blood in their left lung, though, I feel certain.
Dr. Snorri Yodersen got his first look at me while I was in the midst of another hacking fit. He appeared to be in his 40s, though of course he was older than that, like all the members of the Tempe Pack. He was dressed in blue scrubs, which drew attention to the startling blue ice of his eyes and the blonde eyebrows furrowed above them. His sharp nose and chiseled jaw made him look like a thunder god, though considering his pack's antipathy for Thor, that wasn't a compliment I would think of paying him aloud. He had his blonde hair cropped fairly close along the sides, but it was tousled and teased on the top after the fashion of frat boy douchebags, and I wasn't going to tell him that either.
"Atticus, I've seen you looking better," he said, as he kept pace with the gurney being wheeled into pre-op by a couple of nurses. "Tell me what you can when you feel up to it."
"Am I able to talk freely?" I asked, tilting my eyes toward the nurses rolling my gurney.
"Oh yes, they're part of my team," Yodersen said. "You can count on their discretion as long as you pay for it."
"All right, I need blood removed from my left lung then," I said. "And use a local anesthetic. I can't afford to go under."
"If that's all you need, we don't need to cut you open at all. We'll insert a tube down your throat, charge the liquid, and then use magnets to draw it up out of there. We do it for pneumonia patients all the time. You'll still need a local because it tends to hurt like hell, but you'll remain conscious. Good enough?"
"Perfect. Treat this whole thing as outpatient because I need you to let me go right afterward, and you should bill full costs to Magnuson and Hulk. No insurance. Include in your records whatever tests and exams you'd do for a normal human. You know the drill, I'm sure. Make sure you mention the bullet hole and what a good job you did patching it up,
because this is going to get looked at by the cops. No way around it. Am I removing a bullet? No, it passed through me, and they're digging it out of my shop somewhere. So you're sure it traveled cleanly between your ribs? I don't have to worry about any bone chips floating around. As certain as I can be, I'm just half drowned. We entered an elevator and paused until the doors closed. Would you mind if I did a chest x-ray to be sure? The cops are going to want to see one anyway. Kind of a standard procedure. Well, I've already plugged up the holes in my lung and the entry and exit wounds too, so it's going to look a bit odd. Yoderson scowled for the first time. Until then, he'd been conversing with half a grin on his face. That was probably more efficient than you should have been. Well, you're going to charge me thousands for chest bandages I'll never use, so I figure we're even. You and your team will just have to lie convincingly on the stand when you get called up. The elevator bell dinged and the doors opened, and the nurses rolled me into a busy hallway lined with surgical bays. You're going to sue the cops, then? Yoderson asked. Sure, why not? Somebody has to pay for all this, and I'd rather it not be me. You've got a solid case? As solid as Hal can make it. Five cops saw the other cops shoot me when I was standing dead still with my hands up, offering no resistance. Got it on security cam, too. You write up a good story about your medical wizardry, and it's guaranteed. Excellent. I'll be sure to pad the bill. You're the reason we need health care reform, you know? Yoderson's grin returned. There's also going to be the matter of my team's hush money. Sure, no problem. This one's going to get a lot of attention, because the press can't leave something like this alone. Just let Hal know how much, and I'll make sure he gets it to you. Do we have to rush this? The faster the better. You're going to have the police and press here sooner rather than later, and I'd prefer to disappear if I can before they get here. And so, Dr. Snorri Yoderson had me out of there by the time night fell, scooting out a side door in a wheelchair and conveniently missing all the people waiting for me in recovery. We didn't miss the guy waiting by the side door, though. That would be Detective Carlos Jimenez. He was showing some annoying signs of sentience. You're looking pretty good for a guy who got shot in the chest, he said. Detective, I nodded at him. How may I help you? I need a statement. I got shot in Tempe. You're from Phoenix. There's a statement. Two, in fact. I know, Mr. O'Sullivan. I just need your version of events to put in my report. There's always a lot of scrutiny when a cop gets shot, and it gets insane when he gets shot by other cops. So, oblige me, will you? All right. Detective Fagel shot me for no good reason while I had my hands up and was making no threatening movements or statements. The brave and decisive action of Detective Carlos Jimenez prevented me from suffering further injury and possibly saved my life. I'm going to sue Tempe for millions. How's that? That was great, thanks. Where are you off to in such a hurry? Maybe I'm going to a titty bar. It's none of your business. Come on, doctor, let's go. Snorri began to roll me forward, and as he did, Jimenez registered what was slung around the back of my wheelchair. Hey, is that a scabbard? Or a sword, rather? Whoa, deja vu, I said, gesturing for Snorri to keep on pushing. That sounds eerily like the line of questioning Detective Fagels used today when he was supposed to be searching for the dog I don't have. If that's the sword Detective Fagels was talking about, then you removed it from a crime scene, Jimenez replied, walking a pace or two behind us. If it is the same sword, Detective, and that's a big if, since nobody ever saw that imaginary sword but Fagels, then it's just as legally in my possession here as it was in my shop. Good evening, sir. Wait a second, Jimenez said. Where can I find you if I need additional information? You already know where I live and where I work, I said. You're going home, then? He was a persistent bugger. Tell you what, if you cannot find me at home or at work, you may contact me through Hal Hauk, my attorney. My plan had been to be out of the chair and walking north up Civic Center at this point, but Jimenez was kind of putting a crimp in my plans. He noticed this as we ran out of the parking lot and arrived at the street, where Snorri stopped pushing my wheelchair. What? No ride? Jimenez asked. Good night, detective, I said pointedly. He ignored me and addressed Snorri. Has Mr. O'Sullivan been chucked out of the hospital then? Yes, on my authority. And you are? Dr. Snorri Yoderson.
What can you tell me about his condition, Doctor?
I can tell you nothing right now, as you know. But once I receive a proper medical records request, you may, of course, read his chart and my notes yourself. And the sooner you leave me alone, the sooner I can get the paperwork finished.
Well, you're quite a pair,
Jimenez said, folding his arms across his chest and locking his knees. He said nothing more, just stood there and stared at us. I kept my gaze focused on Scottsdale Stadium across the street, and I think Snorri was returning his gaze. I bet Jimenez would blink first. Werewolves, you know. But Snorri didn't have the patience to stare him down baldly. He employed a legal argument to save time.
If you will excuse us, detective, I need to consult with my patient in private, Snorri said,
and then I could practically feel him turning on that werewolf vibe that says back the hell off. It took about 2 seconds for Jimenez to lower his eyes. He said,
Of course, doctor. Good evening to you. And to you, Mr. O'Sullivan. I'll be in touch.
We made no reply as he walked south along the sidewalk for about 25 yards. Then he stopped and pulled out a pack of cigarettes from his jacket and started slapping it against his palm. He looked back at us as he put one between his lips and lit up, clearly intending to wait around to see who gave me a ride.
Annoying.
Snorri, start walking me north towards Civic Center Park, I whispered, confident that he could hear me, and he complied.
I'm going to cast camouflage on myself and the sword now that you're concealing me from his sight, I said. And I'll get up while you're pushing me and walk along with you. I don't think he'll spot the movement since it's dark. When we get up to the corner of 2nd Street, we'll lose him around the corner and you can walk back, saying I caught a ride in a waiting car.
All right, he whispered. He's following us, and he's just pulled out his cell phone.
Can you hear who he's talking to?
Hold on.
For a few moments, there was nothing but the sound of the wheelchair thunking across cracks in the sidewalk. Then Snorri said,
He's asking the Scottsdale police to get a car over here to tail you.
Ha! Won't get here in time. I cast camouflage on myself and on Fragara once more and felt my energy stores dwindle down to Death Valley levels. That was the price I paid for playing wedgie games. Then I rocked myself forward onto the footrests and hopped off into the street so that Snorri could keep pushing the wheelchair as if I were still in it. I tried to take my first deep breath since getting shot and immediately discovered what a bad idea it was.
Don't try to take a deep breath until you heal up fully, Snorri advised me as I gasped and clutched at my throat. That local is probably wearing off, and the tissue in your throat is scraped raw and extremely dry at this point.
Thanks for the timely warning,
I whispered, over what felt like a windpipe made of molten gravel.
That's why I get paid the big bucks, he said lightly.
Speaking of which,
I wheezed,
you might want to have Hal take a look at your report before you hand it over to the cops, just to make sure it's consistent with what actually happened.
Will do.
I turned to look over my shoulder at Jimenez trailing us. He was picking up his pace as he saw us nearing the corner. I reached out to the wheelchair and snagged Fragara from the back and slung it over my shoulder.
I'm going to jog up to the park now. Tell Hal I'll meet him for lunch at Rue La Boule tomorrow at noon and to bring Oberon with him.
Okay. Get well and try not to worry. We have your back.
Thanks, Snorri. You're worth every penny.
I veered off to the right, crossing the deserted street to a wide median populated with old olive trees that gave Civic Center its peculiar character. After drawing some energy from a tree to allow me to breathe more freely, if not without pain, I left Snorri and Jimenez behind to play Where's the Druid, and jogged the last quarter mile to the Civic Center Plaza, an expansive grassy area dotted with some old oaks and the occasional bronze statue. It was a little too manicured for my taste, but it was a large enough source of natural power to take care of my healing needs. I walked a few paces into the grass and sank my fingers into the soil, reaching out with my consciousness to get to know this carefully kept landscape of modern serenity. 5 minutes of meditation revealed to me a place near an oak tree that was rarely trod upon, so I made my way there and shucked myself out of my clothes, folding them neatly and hiding them up in a crook of the tree's branches. I checked my cell phone for messages and had several texts, two from Hal and one from Perry, updating me that all was well for the moment, then turned it off to go completely incommunicado. Then, naked and camouflaged, I lay down on my right side so that my tattoos would have as much contact with the earth as possible, and put Fragara in front of me, nestled against my chest and belly. I placed some precautionary wards about myself, then instructed my body to heal and detoxify while I slept, drawing on the power of Civic Center's abundant, if somewhat chemically assisted, life energy. I had escaped Angus Ogg's machinations on this day, but at the cost of Fagel's life. If I continued to let Angus test my defenses and provide him with a stationary target, eventually he would find a way to break me, especially with a coven of witches backing him up. So it was time to change the game somehow, and I had two choices: run like hell or fight like hell. Running wasn't attractive to me anymore, because I'd been there and done that for two millennia, and since I had basically pledged on my honor to Briett that I would fight for her against Angus, it really wasn't a viable option. On top of that, there was the betrayal of the Sisters of the Three Auroras. My ego didn't want to let a bunch of Polish witches less than half my age get away with bearding me in my own den. So it was going to be fight like hell. And about time, too. I had managed to outdither Hamlet, and the famous Dane's words now haunted me. I do not know why yet I live to say this things to do, sith I have cause and will and strength and means to do it. Hamlet promised himself he'd throw down afterward, but I think perhaps when he said, "From this time forth my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth," the limits of blank verse weakened his resolve somehow. If he'd been free to follow the dictates of his conscience rather than the pen of Shakespeare, perhaps he would have abandoned verse altogether like me and contented himself with this instead. Bring it, motherfuckers. Bring it. Chapter 18. I awoke in the morning remarkably refreshed, but with urgent pressure on my bladder. After relieving myself on the oak tree, out of sight of the few people strolling through the park, I took a deep breath, and it felt remarkably good. I twirled my arms experimentally and felt no tightness in my chest, and I smiled. The earth was so good to me, so giving and so kind. I retrieved my cell phone and powered it on, checking the time. It was 10 a.m., plenty of time to make it to Rulabula. I pulled down my clothes, dressed, slung Fragara across my back, and dispelled the camouflage, walking plainly in the world again. My bear charm was fully charged, and I felt completely restored, albeit dreadfully thirsty and a bit esurient. I had messages from the Tempe Police Department, at first requesting and then demanding that I contact them immediately, as well as messages from Hal, Snorri, and Perry. Hal just wanted me to know that Oberon was a bottomless pit, and while my dog had been very careful with his car's upholstery, and he appreciated it, the blasted canine had destroyed his citrus air freshener for some unknown reason and left it in shreds all over his interior. All business matters, he would tell me at Rulabula. Snorri told me Hal had approved his medical report and thanked me in advance for paying his very large bill. In a message time-stamped at 9:30, Perry called to tell me that the shop door had been successfully replaced. More important, a totally hot blonde woman named Melina had shown up at the shop to say Emily would not require her tea or my services further. The contract was considered fulfilled. Whoa. Did that mean the adorable couple of Angus and Emily had broken up? Or did it mean something else? And he also said she asked about a letter from a friend of hers. She wanted it back really badly, but Perry couldn't find it anywhere in the shop, though he looked. Ah, Melina had tried to get Radomiwa's blood back. I bet she used that hair charm on Perry and he turned the store upside down trying to find it for her. And now I wondered if Fagles and the gang had gone through the books in my study when they searched my house. If they had, they might have found the scrap of paper with Radomiwa's blood on it, and that associate lawyer of Hal's easily could have missed it or not known its significance. Better to save such questions for Hal at Rulabula, I thought. I assumed my house and the shop would be watched, so I took a taxi instead to the Widow McDonough's house.
"Ah, Atticus, my lad."
The widow smiled a cheery greeting and raised her morning glass of whiskey at me from the porch.
"What happened to your bicycle that you're driving up to me door in a taxi?"
"Well, Mrs. McDonough, I had myself one of the most hectic Sundays you could possibly imagine," I said, seating myself in a rocking chair next to hers and sighing in satisfaction. That's always a good thing to do with the widow. She likes to think that her front porch is the most welcoming and relaxing spot in the city. She might be right.
"Did you now? Do tell me, boy."
She clinked the ice in her glass and eyed the level of liquid speculatively.
But first I'll be getting myself a refill, if you wouldn't mind sitting for a spell.
She pushed herself up out of the chair with a couple of creaks and said,
You'll be taking a glass with me, won't you? 'Tisn't Sunday any more, and I can't imagine ye objecting to a cold handful of Tullamore Dew.
Ah, you're right, Mrs. McDonough. I have no need to refuse, nor would I want to. A cold glass would be lovely. The widow's face shone, and her eyes began to fill as she looked down at me gratefully, tousling my hair as she made her way to the door.
You're a fine lad, Atticus, drinking whiskey with a widow on a Monday.
Not at all, Mrs. McDonough, not at all. I really did enjoy her company, and I knew too well the loneliness that clamps around one's heart when loved ones have passed on before. To have that companionship, the comfort of someone being at home for you for years, and then suddenly not to have it anymore, well, every day can seem darker after that, and the vice clutches tighter in your chest every night you spend in a lonely bed. Unless you find someone to spend some time with, and that time is sunlight, golden minutes when you forget you're alone, that vice will eventually crush your heart. My deal with the Morrigan aside, it's other people who have kept me alive so long, and I include Oberon in that. Other people in my life right now who help me forget all the other people I have buried or lost, they are truly magic for me. The widow returned with two glasses of whiskey on the rocks, humming an old Irish tune as she jiggled the ice around. She was happy.
"Now tell me, lad," she said as she sank back into her chair. "What made your Sunday so dreadful?"
I took a sip of the whiskey and enjoyed the burn of the alcohol and the chill of the ice. "At this point, Mrs. McDonough, I'm thinking I should have taken you up on your offer and gone to get baptized. Was the service properly mellow yesterday?" The widow cackled and grinned at me.
"So mellow I can't even remember enough to tell you what the father said. Right boring it was. But you,"
she said, pronouncing the word carefully like an American and grinning,
"had an exciting day?"
"Oh, aye. Got myself shot."
"Shot?"
"Just a flesh wound."
"Attaboy. Who shot ye?"
"A Tempe police detective."
"Lord have mercy. I saw something about that in the paper this morning. Tempe detective shot dead by police, it said. And a subhead said, detective shot civilian without cause. But I didn't read the whole thing."
"Yep, that was me."
"Well, I'll be. Why did the daft fool shoot you? It wasn't because of you killing that worthless Brit bastard, was it?"
"No, not at all," I said. And so I whiled away a pleasant hour telling the widow just enough of the truth to entertain her yet keep her safe. Eventually I made my farewells, promised to trim that grapefruit tree soon, and walked over to Mill Avenue and thence north to Rulabula. I got some odd looks, and people gave me a wide berth when they saw the sword hilt peeking over my shoulder, but otherwise it was uneventful. I got there a few minutes early and Hal wasn't there yet, so I took a seat at the bar and grinned charmingly at Granuaile. Gods below, but she was a vision. Her red hair was still curly and damp from a shower she must have taken right before coming to work. Her teeth flashed white at me for a moment, and then she sauntered over to me with a lopsided smirk on her face.
"I knew I shouldn't have worried," she said. "When I saw that article in the newspaper, I was thinking I might not see you for weeks. And now here you are, a supposed shooting victim, looking downright thirsty."
"Oh, I'm a shooting victim, all right," I said. "I just heal fast." Granuaile's expression abruptly changed. Her eyes narrowed, and she tilted her head to the side as she placed a bar napkin in front of me, and her voice became throatier as she spoke with a newfound accent.
"Druids usually do."
With only three words to work with, all I could do was hazard a guess that the accent was from somewhere on the Indian subcontinent. Then, without much of a pause, the old Granuaile, the perky and beguiling barmaid, was back.
"What'll it be? A Smittix?"
"What? How can you change gears like that? What did you just say to me?"
"I asked if you wanted a Smittix," she said, her face bemused.
"No, what you said before that."
"I said you looked thirsty."
"No, what did you say after that and before the Smittix?"
Granuaile's
eyes boggled at me uncertainly for a moment, and then comprehension dawned, at least it did for her.
"Oh, I know what happened. She must have talked to you.
That's about time. She's been wanting to talk for weeks now." What? Who? You can't throw around pronouns like that without their antecedents if you want people to follow you. She smiled and then held up her hands. Listen, you're going to need a drink and time for a long story.
Well, I'll have a Smittix then, but I don't have much time. I'm meeting my lawyer here in a few minutes.
Gonna sue them, huh?
She grinned as she went to pull a draft for me.
Yes, I'm thinking that they deserve a nice lawsuit. Okay, then. Maybe you can hang out for a little while afterward, and I'll let you talk to her again.
She placed the dark beer down on my napkin and smiled again. I melted inside and began to wonder if it was Granuelle that had this effect on me, or whoever it was she had hitchhiking in her brain. You'll let me? Seemed like whoever it was chose her own time to speak up, and you didn't have much say in the matter.
She doesn't do that often, Granuelle said, brushing off her temporary possession as a minor irritation, as if it were a mosquito bite. Usually she's very polite about leaving me in control.
A name. Give me a name. Who is she? Before she could answer, Hal and Oberon entered the pub, both of them greeting me loudly, though only Hal could be heard and seen by everyone else. Oberon was still in camouflage, but I could see flashes of color shimmering rapidly in the air. He must have been wagging his tail like mad. Someone was bound to notice if that kept up. It wasn't as if Rulabula was empty during the lunch hour.
Atticus, I'm so happy to see you. Werewolves have no sense of humor.
Hi, Hal, I waved, then switched mental gears for Oberon's sake. I'm glad to sort of see you too, buddy. Go hide under the table of an empty booth really quick before someone sees your tail wagging and wonders if they've had too much to drink. I'll come pet you and get some sausages for lunch. Be careful not to run into anyone.
Okay, wow, I've missed you.
I told Granuelle we'd settle up later when I settled down for a nice long talk. She nodded and waved as I followed Hal to a booth where Oberon was waiting, his tail thumping loudly against the seat. People were looking around, wondering what was making the noise.
By Odin's beard, get that hound to calm down, Hal growled.
All right, I'm on it, I said as we slid into the booth. I found Oberon's head and began scratching him behind the ears. Okay, buddy, you need to calm down. Your tail is giving you away.
But I'm so excited to be with you again. You have no idea how bitchy werewolves can be.
I have a pretty good idea, believe me. And I appreciate your being good all that time. That's why I'm getting you two orders of bangers and mash. But you need to chill out because we're starting to get unwanted attention.
Oh, okay, I'll try. But it's really, really hard to chill. I want to play.
I know, but we can't right now. Back up and trap your tail against the wall. There. Now, did you behave perfectly while you stayed with Hal?
Yes. I didn't leave a single mark on his upholstery, and I didn't break anything in his house either.
Aren't you leaving something out? Hal told me you ripped up his air freshener.
I was doing him a favor. No self-respecting canine enjoys the smell of citrus.
You have a point. Quiet now. Here comes the waitress. We ordered two plates of the finest fish and chips and two plates of bangers and mash for Oberon. The poor dog was about to go nuts. I really needed to let him run somewhere until he collapsed. Thanks for your patience, Hal, I said after the waitress left. He's just happy I'm still alive and all that.
Snorri fixed you up then?
That and a night in the park worked wonders. I feel great.
Try to feign some pain when the Tempe police see you, please. You have a bandage on your chest, I hope.
No, but I can put one on if I need to.
Hal nodded. I think it would be wise. It'll be tough to press our suit if they see no evidence of you being shot the day after.
Hal reviewed with me what the security camera revealed, namely that we had the most airtight case possible against the Tempe police for shooting a citizen for no probable cause, and we spent some time hashing out how to deal with police questions, the nature of the suit, and how much we'd ask for. Look, I'm going to give you my instructions now, I said. When the money is finally in your account, I want you to take your cut, then reimburse me for Snorri's fees for last night. The remainder should go to Fagel's family as an anonymous donation, all right? I don't want to profit from some binding of Angus Ogs on an innocent man.
Hal regarded me steadily for a moment as he chewed a succulent piece of beer-battered cod fillet. Then he said in a dry voice,
How very noble of you.
I nearly choked on a chip.
Noble?
I spluttered.
Told you werewolves were bitchy,
Oberon said smugly as he inhaled a sausage. I ignored him and concentrated on Hal's jibe. Nobility has nothing to do with it.
and I'm not knocking you for making a buck on the situation. All I'm saying is that I don't want to profit by it, not even by getting some dubious credit for my charity. Hal apparently had some doubts, but wasn't willing to say them aloud, so all he said was, as he wiped his hands on a napkin. So listen, I said, changing the subject and trying to cover the slobbery licking noises Oberon was making. I got a lead on our mysterious barmaid.
A redhead who smells like two people?
I blinked at him. You never told me that, I said.
As I recall that particular conversation, you asked me if she smelled like a goddess.
He began to tick off my queries on his fingers.
A demon? A lycanthrope? Or some other kind of therianthrope?
Hal smirked.
You were too smitten at the time to ask me what she actually smelled like.
Oberon, is the werewolf telling me the truth?
Don't know for sure. I never paid her much attention, and his nose might be a bit better than mine. If you would just let me go have a nice sniff of her ass, I could...
Never mind. All right, Hal, what else does she smell like?
I've told you all I know, Atticus. You can shift to a hound and smell her yourself if you want.
He placed his hands flat on the table and drummed his fingers, deliberately trying to goad me. Thanks, but I'm going to find out the old-fashioned way. She's going to tell me what's going on after I'm through with you.
Ah, is that my cue to leave, then?
Almost. This might take a while, so I want you to take Oberon with you to the Widow McDonough's house. Hal winced and Oberon whined.
Do I have to? Must I really?
Yes, I said to both of them. They left a bit disgruntled, but quietly enough, leaving me to settle up with the waitress. She looked at the plates of bangers and mash, which looked like they had been licked disturbingly clean, and then at the plates of fish and chips, which had a few scraps of detritus and slaw on them as normal plates would, and then glanced at me uncertainly, knowing that something was very wrong, but unable to imagine a satisfactory explanation. I really enjoy moments like that. Thinking it would be amusing to create another, I dispelled Oberon's camouflage so that the sudden appearance of a huge dog would be sure to startle someone on Mill Avenue, and if that someone was Hal, so much the better. The fine bar at Rue LaBoula had a few more stools available as the slightly sauced lunch crowd returned to their jobs, and Granuel had nothing to do but polish glasses when I sat down in front of her. Head slightly bowed, her green eyes locked onto mine as she seductively licked her upper lip, a coy smile playing at the edges of her mouth. Refusing to be toyed with, I looked up at the high shelves full of whiskey and knick-knacks as if she were doing nothing more interesting than predicting another day of dry heat, and she chuckled at me. "What'll it be, Atticus?" she said, placing a napkin in front of me. "A name, I believe, was where we left off."
"You're going to need a drink first."
"Tell them or do, then, on the rocks."
"You got it.
But you're going to have to be patient. I'm going to tell this my way."
"Your way? No one else's? Like, no one else in your head?"
"That's right. My way," she said, pouring me a generous shot over ice. She placed it squarely in front of me, then folded her arms under her bosom and leaned against the bar, her face only a foot away from mine. Perfect skin. A slight tilt to the end of her nose, strawberry gloss on her lips. It was difficult not to think about kissing her, especially as she pursed her lips for a moment before saying,
"So, you're a druid."
"If you say so, what are you?"
"I am a vessel," she replied, and then her eyes grew round. "Or maybe you should think of me as a vessel with a capital V. That would be more impressive, more mysterious and Scooby-Doo, you know?"
"Okay. A vessel for what? Or for whom?"
"For a very nice lady from southern India. Her name is Lakshakula Sukaran. You should not be alarmed at all by the fact that she's a witch."
Chapter 19. Gods below, I hate witches. Since one of them was probably listening to me through Granuel's ears, however, I thought it more discreet to keep that observation to myself. But doubt would be permissible to express, where outright disdain would not. I gave her my best Harrison Ford half-grin of cynicism, worn by every character from Deckard to Han Solo to Indiana Jones, and picked up my glass. "A nice lady, huh?"
"Very nice." Granuel nodded slowly, ignoring my look of disbelief.
I took a luxurious sip from the glass and waited for her to continue, but apparently the ball was in my court. If doing things her way meant I had to ask more questions, so be it.
And how long has this nice lady had a timeshare in your noggin?
Since shortly after you came back from that trip to Mendocino.
What?
Even though I had just taken a sip of fire water, I suddenly felt cold.
You remember? You turned into a sea otter and removed a pretty golden necklace set with rubies from the hand of a skeleton that was, what, only 50 feet below the surface and a couple of feet beneath the sand?
Chills and thrills at the Irish pub.
How do you know about that?
How do you think? Laksha told me.
Right. But how does she know?
She was originally the owner of that skeleton, but that particular mortal coil failed her in 1850. Since then, and up until recently, she resided in the largest ruby of that necklace. I decided to save all my questions about turning rubies into soul catchers for later.
Then what happened?
Well, you can probably figure it out from there. Once you got the necklace, what did you do with it?
I gave it to a witch named Radomiwa,
who is not as friendly as she likes to pretend, and happens to live upstairs from me in a very stylish urban condo.
And she promptly exorcised Laksha from the necklace.
And that's how I got a roommate in my skull.
Granuel pushed back from the bar and clapped maniacally for me, as if I had just finished playing Rhapsody in Blue in a third-grade talent show.
Well, okay, I understand now, but I think we skipped a few of the details.
I downed the rest of my whiskey, and when I put the glass down, Granuel was there with the bottle, ready to refill it.
You're going to need a double, she said, pouring more than was probably advisable. Nurse that for a bit while I get some work done.
Then she slid out of my vision to attend to her few remaining customers.
I had plenty of thoughts to nurse along with the whiskey. Indian witches, in my limited experience, were capable of some really dark hoodoo, and any witch capable of jumping out of one body into a gemstone and then into another body after 160 years or so had some serious magical muscle. My main question was how I could get the witch out of Granuel's head safely, and who else would have to suffer to make it happen. The witch obviously wanted my help with something, and I could only assume that she wanted a new body to inhabit. But I didn't have any of those currently in stock, and bodies were one of the few things you couldn't buy, yet, on Amazon. Whatever this Indian witch wanted from me, I knew it would mean quite a bit of trouble, and it didn't escape me that I owed the lot of it to Radomiwa, along with so many other recent woes. A confrontation with her, and by extension her entire coven, might soon be unavoidable. On this gloomy note, Granuel returned.
Right about now I bet you're wondering what Laksha wants, she said lightly.
That thought had indeed crossed my mind.
But what you should be wondering is what your favorite bartender wants.
Is that so? I grinned. She nodded.
It is. You see, I kind of like having Laksha in my head. She's been teaching me all kinds of stuff.
Such as?
Such as all the monsters are real. The vampires and the ghouls and even the chupacabra.
Really? How about the Sasquatch?
She doesn't know about that one. It's too modern. But all the gods are real. And for some reason, almost everyone who knows him thinks that Thor is a giant dick. But the most interesting thing she's told me so far is that there's still one honest-to-goodness druid walking around after all the rest have died, and I've served him a whole lot of dark beer, bottles and bottles of whiskey, and occasionally flirted with him shamelessly.
Well, if you're going to flirt, that's the only way to do it.
Are you really older than Christianity?
There was no use lying. The voice in her head had already told her everything. Besides, the whiskey was good, and I could blame everything I said on it if I had to.
Yep, I admitted. And how did you manage that? You aren't a god.
Hermit, I said simply, thinking Granuel would have no idea what I was talking about. She narrowed her eyes.
Are you talking about Hermit, daughter of D.N.K., sister of Mia who was slain? She asked.
That sobered me up some.
Wow, you'd win a shitload of money on Jeopardy with a brain like that. They teach Celtic mythology at the university here?
Refusing to be distracted, Granuel pressed.
You're telling me you know the herb lore of Hermit? The 365 herbs grown from the grave of Mia?
Aye, all of it.
And why would she have shared such priceless knowledge with you?
That was a story for another day. Can't tell you. I shook my head with seeming regret. You're too young.
Granuel snorted. Whatever. So is this lore of Ermit's the secret to your eternal youth? I nodded. I call it immortality because I'm fond of puns. I drink it every week or so, and I stay fresh and unspoiled. So this handsome face of yours isn't an illusion. It's really you. Yes. Biologically, I'm still 21. Out fucking standing. Wow. She leaned forward over the bar again, even closer than she had before. So here's what I want, Atticus. I could smell her strawberry lip gloss, the peppermint of her breath, and that peculiar scent that I now knew was only half hers, red wine bouquet mixed with saffron and poppies. I want to be your apprentice. Teach me.
Truly? That is what you want? I raised my eyebrows.
Yes. I want to be a druid.
I hadn't heard that one in more than a century. The last person to ask me to teach them was one of those silly Victorians who thought druids wore white robes and grew beards like cumulonimbus clouds. I see. And what do I get in return?
Laksha's help, her gratitude, and mine.
Let's put some details with each of those, if we're bargaining.
Laksha knows you have a problem with Radomiwa.
Wait, I said, putting up a hand to forestall her speech. How does she know that?
Two of the coven came in here yesterday while I was working, and she, or rather I, overheard snatches of their conversation. When I heard your name, I started paying attention. They were talking about taking something away from you, but I don't know what because they never called it by name.
I grimaced. I know what they want. Did they say how they were going to manage it?
No, they were talking about how they'd be rewarded once they got it.
Interesting. What did they say?
They mentioned Ma'mel.
You're kidding. Ma'mel? He was going to give them passage through there?
That and a permanent estate.
Unbelievable. My nostrils flared and my fingers tightened around my glass. Do you know what Ma'mel is?
I had to look it up, but yes, it's one of the Fey Plains. The really posh one.
Aye, the really beautiful one. And it's being sold off to Polish witches. I wonder if Mananan MacLear knows anything about it. Mananan was supposed to be the ruler of Ma'mel. If he knew about Angus Ogg's promise and had done nothing, then he was part of the collusion against Briat. The more likely scenario was that Angus Ogg was plotting against Mananan as well.
I don't have an answer for that, Granuel replied. But I heard one say to the other that they had to leave because Radomiwa would be waiting for them. Obviously that piqued Laksha's interest, and that's how she knows your interests and hers coincide. She wants you to get her a shot at Radomiwa so she can get the necklace back.
If you live below Radomiwa, why can't she just take a shot any night of the week?
Radomiwa's condo is highly protected. The same as your home is probably protected. Laksha needs you to get Radomiwa out of her safety zone and keep her distracted for about 5 minutes.
That's it?
And maybe get something of Radomiwa's.
Ah, I see. How about a drop of her blood?
That'll do. Granuel said.
Does Laksha realize that besides the two you saw here, Radomiwa has 11 other witches in her coven, all of them magically accomplished? She's picking a pretty big fight.
Laksha can take them all once she has her necklace back.
Really? If that wasn't overconfidence, then it was pretty scary. I'd be able to hold off a coven like theirs long enough to run away. Take them all out by myself? Not so much. What's so special about the necklace?
I'll let her tell you soon.
Granuel waved away the question.
Don't get distracted. Laksha says that she's already grateful to you for rescuing her from the sea, but if you help her earn true freedom again, she will grant you any boon that is in her power to give.
And how do I earn her true freedom?
Distract Radomiwa so that she can get the necklace back.
There has to be more to it than that. For example, where is she going to go? Into Radomiwa or back into the necklace? She's not staying in your head, is she?
No. Granuel shook her head. She's been a wonderful guest, but we're both ready to be alone with our thoughts again. I will let her explain that. Last but not least, you'll have my gratitude. I'm not able to grant you magical favors, but considering that apprentices in the old days were worked pretty hard, I'm sure I'll be working off my debt to you.
What if I don't want an apprentice? I asked. I've been doing just fine without one.
Oh, I see. Getting shot is doing just fine, is it? Why can't I help you get Laksha out of your head and call it a day?
No deal. Laksha won't go unless you agree to my apprenticeship.
What? I furrowed my brow. This was wholly unexpected. Typically, any being capable of possessing another cares very little about the wants and needs of those it possesses.
Why does she care?
She knows that I don't want to be pulling drafts all day for every Mike and Tom who comes in here. I want to do something fantastic with my life. I'm only 22, you know, she said. I want to learn.
That's good, because there's not much else to being a druid's apprentice than learning. But if I don't agree, then what happens? Laksha stays in your head forever?
Granuel shrugged. No, we'll figure out something else. Eventually we'll try to get the necklace back without your help. See if someone else in town would like to earn the gratitude of a sorceress.
And what of you then? Will you try to become something else?
Granuel nodded and held my eyes. Hers were emerald dappled with light, and they reminded me of home. If you leave me no other option, I'll become a witch like Laksha. But it's not my first choice.
Oh, and why is that?
I asked the question casually, but it was a deadly serious one, perhaps the most serious question of all. If she took this opening to make a joke, or to flirt, or kiss my ass, I would tell her no right then. But she paused before answering, perhaps getting coached by Laksha?
There are several reasons, actually, she began in a low voice. Laksha knows a great deal about magic, because she's been around for a long time. But she knows you are older than she is. Much older than any other being she's ever met, aside from gods. If that is true, then it follows you would know even more than she does, and would have seen things the rest of us can only read about. And that is why I want you to teach me. I want to know what truly happened in history from someone who is there. I want to know the things you know, especially the things humanity has forgotten or never knew in the first place. It's just the general principle that knowing is better than not knowing. Knowledge is power and so on.
I've heard worse. She walked up to the precipice of brown nosing, took a good look, but stepped back at the last moment.
Another reason, she continued, is that I think Laksha's magic is a bit scary, and I say that hoping she isn't offended.
She rolled her eyes up for a moment, apparently conducting some internal dialogue. Then she looked back at me.
I think that much of what she has told me about her magic, and much of what I've read about magic with true power behind it, is a bit alarming. It seems to involve trafficking with H.P. Lovecraft action figures, and there are some rituals that I would have a problem with morally, and, like, digestively. Toenails and body fluids, ew.
She shuddered.
But your power, a druid's power, comes from the earth, right?
That's correct. She pointed at my right arm.
Laksha tells me those tattoos aren't just for show.
She's right.
That sounds like something I could live with.
Are you sure? It limits you. A druid cannot do all the things a witch can do. If it's power you're after, then witches can access far more of it faster than a druid can.
There are different kinds of power, Granuel shot back. And witches have the power to dominate and destroy. Your power is to defend and build.
Nah, no. I shook my head. I think you're romanticizing quite a bit. My powers can also be used to dominate and destroy. Angus Oak had certainly dominated Fagles, and Bress had tried to destroy me using a glamour.
Okay, granted, she conceded. Anything can be twisted from its original intent. But the intent is what I'm talking about, Atticus. Laksha knows of rituals and spells that cannot possibly be, you know, benign. The difference is your magic can be twisted to evil purposes, but some of the magic Laksha knows cannot ever be good. That's an important distinction for me.
So what do you think a druid is? I asked. If she mentioned white robes and ZZ Top beards, I would scream.
They are healers and wise people, she said. Tellers of tales, repositories of culture, shapeshifters according to some stories, and able to exert a little influence over the weather.
Not bad, I said. Do they ever kick ass? I said it flippantly, but she knew this was a test.
Occasionally they kicked some ass in battles. Granuel frowned. I mean, according to some of the old legends. But they used swords and axes to do that, not magic force. That's a nice sword you have there, by the way, she said, tilting her chin to the hilt of Fragora, peeking over my shoulder. Are you planning on kicking some ass? I ignored her question and asked her another. What did the druids do in the old legends you read? Mostly they advised kings and tried to predict the future. Oh, I forgot that. Divination is kind of a druid thing. Do you cut open animals and look at their guts? She crinkled her nose at me and held her breath. No, I answered, shaking my head, and she relaxed. I prefer to cast wands. There, see? She tapped me teasingly on the arm. You don't destroy things.
Do you seriously want to become a druid initiate? Before you answer, let me explain what that would involve, because Laksha could not possibly know. And if you've been reading any of that New Age crap that says you only need to take some plant life and pray to Briet or the Morrigan, well, it's not like that. First, you get 12 years of memorizing things. No spells, nothing remotely cool or powerful. Just memorizing and regurgitating for 12 years. You might be able to knock off a year or so because you're starting later than most initiates and your brain is fully developed. But still, it's a long time. You have to seriously like books and learning and languages, because you'd have to learn a few, and that's all you'd do, full-time, until you're in your 30s.
Oh, she said in a tiny voice. What about paying bills and things like that?
You'd have to quit your job here and come work for me in my bookstore. To relieve the tedium of reading books, I can occasionally allow you the tedium of selling them to other people. And maybe I'll teach you how to brew some special teas.
Wow, okay.
After you pass all your tests, we can start teaching you some magic. But you have to be able to draw power for that, and that means getting yourself tattooed ritualistically with vegetable-based dyes. It takes 5 months.
5 months?
Granuel's eyes bugged. I just told you about 12 years of study up front, and you didn't even blink. And now you're worried about 5 months?
Well, this is 5 months of getting stabbed with a needle, right?
Thorns, actually. This is very old school. Doesn't get much older.
Yeah, see, that's a bit different than curling up with a book and a mug of hot chocolate.
But it's necessary if you want to perform druidic magic. It's a ritual that binds you to the earth and allows you to tap its power. And once you're bound to it, you will never want to do anything to harm it. Angus Og might be dealing with demons these days, if Briet's right, but even he wouldn't dare mess with the earth. After I said that, it occurred to me that a man willing to deal with demons might do much worse. So I added,
I hope. Sotto voce. You talked to Briet? And who's Angus Og? You mean the old Irish love god?
Yeah, him, I said, mildly surprised and impressed that she was able to place the name, though I shouldn't have been after she had correctly identified Ermit. But forget I mentioned him. The point is, Granuel, it'll be more than a decade before you get to feel anything that can be called magical power. If you're anxious to start wielding magic, Laksha might know a ritual that can get you started tonight. What kind of patience do you have?
The right kind, she said, and I have enough.
She reached out and covered my hand with hers, giving it a gentle squeeze.
I truly want this.
You said you're 22. Don't you have a college degree already? She rolled her eyes at me.
Yeah, I graduated in May with a degree in philosophy. And now I tend bar because what the hell else am I going to do with a philosophy degree?
All right, I said after studying her face. I'll take your application seriously and consider it. But before I make a decision, I need to speak to Laksha.
I figured as much.
She twisted her lips in an expression of regret and let her hand slip back to her side.
I need to work a bit before I let her take over, though. She doesn't know jack about bartending. Hold on.
She quickly revisited her lingering patrons, getting a refill here, closing out a check there, distributing smiles and thanks and drinks with equal facility. Tullamore dew trickled down my throat as I considered her and reviewed why I hadn't had an apprentice in more than 1,000 years. Mostly it was because everyone thought the druids had all died out, and they didn't know there was still someone around to ask for training. I was kind of like Yoda, chilling out in the Dagobah system. But even when people found me, as they occasionally did, as Granuel just had, training someone had been impractical, because I had to remain mobile and I couldn't afford to stay in one place for so long. I had also been working on my necklace for much of that time, and you can't concentrate on a project like that with constant questions and the need to plan instruction for someone else.
My last apprentice had left this plane near the very end of the 10th century. He was a bright, earnest lad named Sebron, who managed to play the role of an illiterate Catholic peasant convincingly while learning the mysteries of the earth from me. I was hiding underneath the skirts of the Holy Roman Empire at the time, a far-flung fold of its skirts, really, near the city of Compostela in the Kingdom of Galicia. I had a modest farm a couple of miles from town, and everyone liked me because I gave all the credit for my crops to Jesus and paid the clergy generous tithes. Sebron's father was a smith in town, and he sent his son out to my farm a few times a week to get fresh produce and eggs from the chickens I kept. He paid me with Sebron's labor on the farm, and that's how we found time to conduct his education. He had nearly completed his studies, and we were about to travel into the woods to begin his tattoos, when Al-Mansur's forces swept up from the southern caliphate and sacked the city in 997, killing him and his father before I could get there to protect him. That was when I gave up on trying to be a teacher. Neither I